there are still far too many New Mexicans who are coming in to contact with one another.
On Wednesday, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham issued new emergency orders to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Good afternoon, I'm Anthony Morneau. Today we discuss COVID-19 and New Mexico during this special New Mexico Public Radio call-in program. Our guest this hour will be infectious disease researcher Dr. Michael Woods. Dr. Woods is the director of the Biosciences Research Laboratory at the Burrell College of Osteopathic Medicine in Las Cruces. His research on the Uganda plague outbreak has been honored by the CDC. Join us to learn what research has shown us so far on COVID-19 after the news. Thank you for joining us for this statewide call-in program on COVID-19. I'm Anthony Morneau reporting from KRWG Public Media in Las Cruces. This program is a collaboration between KRWG and New Mexico Public Radio stations KUNM and KANW in Albuquerque and KENW in Portales. The number to call to ask a question during this program regarding research that has been done so far on coronavirus is 888-922-5794. I'll give that again, 888-922-5794. On Wednesday, New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham issued new orders to limit the spread of the coronavirus by limiting restaurants to takeout service and delivery, as well as closing down movie theaters, gyms, and shopping centers. The governor stressed social distancing during the update and also announced 5 new positive tests, bringing the state total to 28 infections. Now, we do have some breaking news right now. That number is now at 35 positive tests of COVID-19 in New Mexico. The most recent cases are 4 people in Bernalillo County, 1 person in San Miguel County, and 2 people in Santa Fe County. Joining us for this discussion is infectious disease researcher Dr. Michael Woods. Dr. Woods is an associate professor and director of the Biosciences Research Laboratory at the Burrell College of Osteopathic Medicine in Las Cruces. His research on Uganda plague outbreak response has been honored by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and his work in global security was honored by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. Dr. Woods, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Now, I also want to inform our listeners that they can like the KRWG Public Media Facebook page and join in the conversation on our live stream, where Casey Counts is anchoring our social media desk. Dr. Woods, I'd like to start off with some facts, and can you inform us on the research of what we know so far on COVID-19 and how it originated?
Sure. So this is a brand new virus. This is a virus we have not previously seen before or necessarily been aware of. So just to kind of clarify something up front, when we say COVID-19, what we're actually referring to is the name of the disease that is caused by this new virus. So COVID-19 stands for coronavirus disease 2019, referring to the emergence of this new virus at the end of last year. The name of the virus itself is actually SARS coronavirus 2, or SARS-CoV-2. And so this is a coronavirus, which is a type of virus that we're all very familiar with already. Coronaviruses are a common cause of the common cold, and typically we're exposed to these fairly regularly in our lives. This particular virus appears to have originated in bats. That is based on genetic sequencing information we have on the virus, indicating that its closest relative is actually a virus that's previously been found in bats. And so that is likely the route that this virus took, jumping from bats, possibly through an intermediate host, and then into the human population. So that's what we know about the origins of this virus so far.
If you're just joining us, we are discussing research on COVID-19. With us is Dr. Michael Woods. He is an infectious disease researcher and director of the Biosciences Research Laboratory at the Borrell College of Osteopathic Medicine in Las Cruces. The number to call to ask a question is 888-922-5794. Or you can go ahead and like the KRWG Public Media Facebook page and join in the conversation there as well. We are going to go ahead and take some calls right now. We have a call from Peter regarding coronavirus. Peter, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
My question is, about 4 weeks ago, the middle of February, I did develop something that seemed to me similar to what we're talking about now, like mainly respiratory, very difficult to breathe, and a lot of congestion in the lungs. And I'm wondering if I could have had the coronavirus back then, about 4 weeks ago, mid-February.
Dr. Woods, can you kind of explain to us what the research shows us, how the virus really interacts with the body?
Well, so the virus actually enters the body through a mucous membrane. That could be the mouth, the nose, even the eyes, or, of course, the lungs. And that seems to be where this virus first attacks the body and infects the body. And from there, it replicates, and then it can spread within the body, and it often spreads to the lungs. So that's why the symptoms that are seen usually relatively early in the disease, the cough, the fever, those reflect the changes that are occurring in our upper respiratory tract as this infection is taking hold.
Okay. Now, what in the symptoms?
The symptoms that are consistent with this infection, cough, fever, and shortness of breath, which are actually very similar to the flu and other respiratory illnesses.
All right. Peter, are you feeling better now?
I'm feeling better, but my question is there, will the test that they're giving now, will that show if you already have it?
Right.
Had it?
So that's an important question. So the test that we're using right now to diagnose this infection detects the presence of the virus itself. It's looking for fragments of the virus's genome, its genetic material. And so the test that's being used and that we're going to start seeing being used much more widely here in the state over the next few days really gives a positive signal only while you are actively infected and while virus is present. Now, someone that was previously infected, perhaps 4 weeks ago, chances are today the virus is no longer present. And so at that point, what we need is a measure of an indirect measurement of past infection. And often how that's done is looking for the presence of antibodies that are specific to the virus. And so that's a different type of test. That is not what's being used right now widely. But my guess is that as we move forward, those types of tests may become more available, and that's what it would take to give us, evidence of how long the virus has perhaps been present in the population without us knowing.
Okay, I'm sorry. Did you have a follow up real quick? We have some other calls.
Well, just a short one. So I'm understanding that it showed its head here in about January. Is that correct? So there's a very good possibility that, yeah, we could have been exposed to it, the beginning of February and had it already. Is that true?
We can't rule that out without further data. I would say that we have been looking for the virus in critically ill patients since we first started detecting infections here in the U.S. Could there have been other infections present in the community? It's possible. but we really need data to say for sure.
All right, Peter, we want to thank you for the call. We are now going to Ted. Ted, do you have a question for Dr. Woods?
Yes, I sure do. I'm interested in knowing what a person should do when they bring food home from the store, and also whether or not microwaving bring-home food, or takeout food, I should call it, is a way of disinfecting. I have thought possibly about washing the food with the hose outside and letting it air dry and then bringing it in. Could you discuss that topic?
Thank you, Ted.
Well, what I will say is that heat generally is effective at controlling microbial pathogens. This particular virus does not have any necessarily unique features that makes it more resistant to heat. So to be perfectly honest, I haven't seen data with this specific virus demonstrating that microwave is effective. But generally speaking, reheating food certainly to the point probably well in excess of 120, 130 degrees generally is effective at destroying pathogens. Now, as far as washing food, you know, I guess I would say that generally it's a good idea to wash produce and that type of food when we bring it home. But overall, I would say the risk of bringing this organism home on food is probably relatively low compared to acquiring it from someone ill in the community. But again, that's a good question. But I've seen no evidence or no data to indicate that food is a major vector of transmission in this case.
If you're just joining us, we are talking COVID-19 in New Mexico. Our guest in studio is Dr. Michael Woods, an infectious disease researcher. He is director of the Biosciences Research Laboratory at the Burrell College of Osteopathic Medicine in Las Cruces. The number to call to ask a question is 888-922-5794. You can also ask a question on our Facebook page, the KRWG Public Media Facebook page, where Casey Counts is anchoring our social media desk. We are now going to another caller. Sarah has a question. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. When I was a kid, before vaccinations were universal, the doctor would take blood, take 2 or 3 days to identify the bug, and then inject an antigen. It comes from the blood of people who have recovered it, and then it's grown in eggs, from what I remember. Is that something that we can develop?
So when we say injecting an antigen, usually what that refers to is injecting a protein from the pathogen or from the virus itself, and that is essentially the basis of vaccination. Now, what we are seeing discussed in the medical literature is the possibility of doing essentially a passive immunity, a transfer of passive immunity by taking the serum from people that have recovered from coronavirus disease and actually using that to treat people that are actively infected. And the basis of that, at least the theory of that, is based on the presence of neutralizing antibodies in those patients that have recovered. This is something I know has been looked at in China. I have not seen, I haven't seen published literature demonstrating that is a reliable outcome, but that is often used to treat other infections.
Okay.
Yeah. I just used the wrong word, antigen. I should have said antibody. But
okay.
I think it would be a good idea to develop here.
Thank you so much for the call, Sarah. We are going now to David, who has a question. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my phone call. I'm up in Taos, New Mexico. So, you know, I've been trying to read, you know, read online and as best I can as a layperson, break down information and statistics, even though I know they're ever-changing and moving, about, you know, the dangers, the death rates of, per people infected and everything. One of the reasons I have been doing this is that I feel like I get a lot of pushback from people in my community, relatively speaking, that there's fear-mongering going on, that it's blown out of proportion, people are outright saying there's not a lot of danger, and I want to be armed with a rebuttal to that. I have a lot of respect for the world healthcare professionals, people with PhDs, and I don't think that they would be calling for the conditions, you know, that we're all putting ourselves in, isolation and social distancing, if it were not for a good reason. So a lot of people are citing common flu and the deaths and the statistics of common flu this year from previous years, and the rate that people die from it, and pointing out that much less people are dying from this COVID-19. And I would like to have a little bit of understanding shed on why health professionals are being so cautious around this and how you would distinguish it from the dangers of the common flu.
You know, David, you bring up an interesting thing. Dr. Woods, you know, some have made statements downplaying the danger of COVID-19. By comparing it to the flu, can you kind of explain why that's a false comparison?
Well, I think there's a few important things that we have to consider here. One, we're still in the early stages of this epidemic here in the United States. This is a virus that we have no pre-existing immunity to in our population, which means that most, if not all of us, are susceptible to the virus. And the other issue is that we have no countermeasures currently against this virus. We have a vaccine that we use every year to vaccinate people against the flu. We can use that to target vulnerable populations. We can use that in children. You know, we're all encouraged to get that. And that works very well at helping reduce the numbers of flu every year. Now, we do still have tens of thousands of deaths from flu every year here in this country, and that is based on a case fatality rate that's generally around 0.1%. Okay, the data that we're seeing come out of places like South Korea, where there's been a very large scale testing, so we have a little bit more confidence and the true number of infections, is showing that the case fatality rate in this case is approximately 10 times that, or around 1%. Okay, so if we think about this infection spreading through the population, potentially being able to infect a vast majority of us over time, and if that 1% case fatality rate holds up, then we're talking about very large numbers of deaths. And that's why we're seeing the response that we're seeing, and that we are trying to get ahead of this. We're trying to reduce the rate of spread through the population so that we can protect those people that are most vulnerable to the severe complications. And hopefully over time, we'll be able to develop an effective vaccine that we can then start deploying to help control this pandemic. But, that's obviously a question that comes up a lot. Flu is with us constantly. It cycles through our population seasonally, and we have a certain familiarity with it. But there are some differences here. One of those is that higher case fatality rate, the fact that we have no way to induce immunity in the population right now outside of acquiring that naturally. So I do think there is reason for us to be concerned about the long-term implications of this, and it's important that we try to get ahead of it. We don't have a full picture on what the outcome is going to be, whereas we can fairly reliably predict that in any given year with influenza, But I do think that we recognize that this is a serious enough concern that we need to implicate apply some fairly robust measures to again, try to get ahead of this.
Okay, thanks for the call, David. If you're just joining us, we are talking COVID-19 in New Mexico. Good afternoon. I'm Anthony Moreno. I am reporting from KRWG Public Media in Las Cruces. This program is a collaboration between KRWG and New Mexico Public Radio stations KUNM and KANW in Albuquerque and KENW in Portales. The number to call to ask a question on the research, what we know, is 888-922-5794. You can also join in the conversation on our social media desk. Our guest is Dr. Michael Woods. He is an infectious disease researcher and associate professor and director of the Biosciences Research Laboratory at the Burrell College of Osteopathic Medicine in Las Cruces. Speaking of social media, we are going to our social media desk right now where Casey Counts is. Casey, good afternoon. What are people saying on social media? Do we have any questions?
Yes, but let me first start by giving a shout out to my Greyhounds of ENMU listening in Portales today. And Marie had a question for us. Given that younger doctors in China succumb to the illness, is the amount of virus a person is exposed to related to how severe their symptoms can be?
That's a great question. We don't have any data with this particular virus that speaks to that. We can say that generally there is a dose response to most infectious agents. And so when we study other infectious agents, one of the important measures, certainly in animal models of infection, is the infectious dose, or even the infectious dose, or even the lethal dose. And so there is often a relationship there between dose, between outcomes, and likelihood of survival. So we have no data to suggest what that might be with this particular virus. And that's, again, those are very hard measurements to make in people. It is something that is often calculated in animal models that are used to explore the pathogenesis of these infections, but that is a fairly common phenomenon that we see. Again, that relationship between infectious dose and outcomes.
All right, thank you very much. And as a follow-up, it seems like we're seeing more and more younger people being actually hospitalized with COVID-19, say 25 to 44 age group. Is that something that you're seeing as well?
Well, certainly there are numerous news reports out there floating around that tend to point to this. Most of the data that these recommendations have been based on so far to date have been based on the studies that have come out of China and their experience dealing with this beginning in January, or even actually as far back as December and through January into February. There was one study in particular that looked at tens of thousands of documented infections in China. And based on that data, there was a pretty convincing trend, or relationship rather, between age and likelihood of a severe complication or severe or poor outcomes. It's possible that we will see those trends change as we get more data out of places like Europe and Italy and even here in the country. But for the most part, most of the data we have still indicates that the elderly are high risk. Those with underlying health conditions are at higher risk for severe complications. I think that we will start to see more data published that if there is a relationship or a change in those trends, that will show up in the data. But at this point, I don't know that there's sufficient data out there that's been published to say that otherwise healthy young people are at any higher risk than anyone else at this point.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, an interesting point that it reminds me of the recent New York Times article that was published on the new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that found out nearly 2,500 recorded cases in the U.S. Out of the first cases, the oldest patients they cited had the greatest likelihood of dying, but out of the 508 patients known to have been hospitalized, that report says 38% were between 20 and 54. Does that kind of make you think of anything that we may that may concern you, or any thoughts on
that?
Well,
there's always going to be a distribution, right? There's always going to be a range associated with these data. And so we cannot say that those that are in their 20s or 30s will never have a severe outcome. There will be individuals in those populations that, for reasons we may be able to explain, or potentially for reasons we can't explain yet, will have overall a negative outcome. But if we look at the data in bulk so far, it does tend to weight more heavily towards the older population. Now, it's possible that, young people that are potentially dealing with other comorbidities, they may, be at increased risk even though they're young. They might have underlying risk factors. But at this point, I haven't seen sufficient data that indicates that young people are especially vulnerable here. In fact, I think we all appreciate that those that are under 20 years old rarely experience severe complications.
Okay, if you're just joining us, we are talking COVID-19 in New Mexico. Our guest is Dr. Michael Woods. He is an infectious disease researcher. His research on Uganda plague outbreak response has been honored by the Centers for Disease Control. The number to call to ask a question is 888-922-5794. Now, I do want to let you know that we have a constant ring out going on right now, so hang on with us. If you don't want to wait, you can go to our Facebook page and like the KRWG Public Media Facebook page, where Casey Counts is anchoring our social media desk. You can join in the conversation there. We're now going to the phone lines, and we have, I believe, Christy waiting to ask a question. Christy, thanks for joining us.
I actually just called to listen in.
Oh, okay. Well, you can also join in our Facebook page if you want to carry on there. Thank you for calling in. We are now going to go to Marcy, who has a question. Marcy, good afternoon, and thanks for joining us. Do you have a question for Dr. Woods?
Hi, yes, I do. So I'm a teacher. I'm 67. I work with students one-to-one. I have a student load of about 12 students, and their ages are 9 to 15. And this week I've taken off. Next week, my school would like me to resume working with students one-to-one, and I would be working about 30 hours, so that would be my exposure time. And my classroom is very small, and the students' homes have parents that are working in very public settings. So they include nurses, people who work at airports. So my two questions. First is, how should we regard one-to-one settings? Is that safe if we take precautions? And second question, if I am meeting with students next week ongoing, would it be recommended that we wear masks, hand washing when they enter and leave, that we, keep the distance, and of course I'd be cleaning in between each student.
Oh, thanks for the question, Marcy.
So, this is an important question.